Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Masella.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, Secretary of Health and Human Services Sylvia Burwell has issued an interesting challenge. A competition to see which developer can produce a medical bill design that actually is user-friendly. Sounds simple, but it's really no small feat.
They're looking for a design that delivers a medical bill that's clearer, less complex, and easier to understand in a way that will improve the patient's financial experience. Well, you're right, Mark. That is a pretty tall order, as anyone who's ever tried to understand an explanation of benefits or a bill knows.
The problem is that so many practices switched to electronic medical records in recent years, and they were designed to accommodate far more coding complexity. Unfortunately, they've become too complex for many consumers to understand.
The winners of the competition will be announced in the fall. I'm sure there are many people looking forward to the outcome of this competition. Mark, I know I am.
There's another healthcare experience that's become increasingly complex, the prescribing of pain medications, particularly narcotics-based pain meds. And it elicited a demand from some Harvard medical students. They demanded a more effective curriculum to prepare them to confront this deadly problem that's become so prevalent in this country. Opioid overdoses, which has led to tens of thousands of deaths in recent years.
Well, we're seeing similar responses from all the professional associations, but interesting to see it coming from the students themselves. That's a really interesting form of student activism. I understand the students actually organize their own training sessions on not only how to treat opioid addiction, but how to be better prescribers as well, how to recognize different kinds of pain and the best way to manage it. And as we know from our own experience and from our pain management project, ECHO, it's a very complex issue, requires excellent and ongoing training and preparedness. I think it's very impressive that the students themselves recognize what a crisis this is and have both demanded and created better training.
Addiction and mental health issues are very much on the mind of our guest today, Margaret. Paul Gianfrido, a longtime friend and mental health activist and CEO of Mental Health America, an organization dedicated to making mental health services a part of comprehensive primary care to address the great unmet need in this important area.
And Lori Robertson will be stopping by, the managing editor of factcheck.org. She looks at misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain. And no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com.
And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you.
We'll get to our interview with Paul Gianfrido of Mental Health America in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. The CDC and National Institute for Allergy and Infectious Diseases at NIH are keeping their eyes on close to 300 women in the U.S. and American territories who are pregnant and have been exposed to the Zika virus. 157 pregnant women in the continental U.S. and 122 in its territories have tested positive for the virus, which causes severe birth defects in some women and also miscarriages. The link between in utero exposure to Zika and a condition known as microcephaly has been confirmed. Of the 544 cases of Zika reported in the U.S. so far, most have been acquired through a mosquito bite, but there are 10 cases of infection reported to have happened through sexual transmission. The president had asked for $1.9 billion to combat the Zika virus, trying to develop a vaccine and treatments for those pregnant women at higher risk. The Senate approved a version that gives $1.1 billion. And a House bill allocates just $600 million, taking money away from state health departments around the country. The president said he'll veto the House bill. Meanwhile, the president has also asked for $1.1 billion to help combat the opioid crisis, which has grown dramatically in recent years. According to a recent study published in Health Affairs, it's behind a significant jump in hospital use and costs. In 2002, 300,000 hospitalizations were directly related to opioid issues. In 2012, there were 520,000 opioid-related hospitalizations, the epidemic costing the healthcare system an estimated $15 billion in hospital costs in 2012, a number that has only risen since then. The FDA's new food nutrition labels are now on packages at a store near you. The newer, and in some cases more blunt, labels have had enlarged things like the total calories and serving sizes. And there's an added component that had the sugar lobby in a lather, a new line that shows the amount of added sugars to a food item. The lobby had argued all sugars are sugars. The administration fought back and won the battle that consumers need to understand how much non-nutritional sugar is being added to a food so they can make choices based on awareness of nutrient density of the product. High sugar content in food has been linked to obesity and the growing tsunami of type 2 diabetes. Americans are less enchanted with their marketplace insurance plans as time goes on. According to a Kaiser Family Foundation study, high deductibles and higher out-of-pocket costs are leading to increased dissatisfaction with the plans. Study showed that in 2014, 27% of Americans polled were dissatisfied with the plans. In 2016, that number jumped to 40%. However, there's still overall satisfaction with the insurance coverage, 68% still in favor of having it. You can find the whole study at kff.org. And the world is living longer. World Health Organization released a report showing the average life expectancy has grown by 5 years around the world, led by a jump in life expectancy in sub-Saharan Africa of some 10 years, due largely to better malaria control and expanded HIV treatments. The U.S., conversely, only saw a jump in life expectancy of about 2 years. Japanese women have the highest life expectancy, 87 years, with Swiss men having the highest male life expectancy at around 81 years. All that mountain air and Swiss cheese. I'm Ariane O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
Hi, we're speaking today with Paul Gianfrido, President and CEO of Mental Health America, the nation's oldest community-based nonprofit organization committed to improving mental health in this country. Mr. Gianfrido was appointed in 2013 to the National Advisory Council at the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Service Administration. He has also served as president of Quantum Foundation, as executive director of Indigent Care in Austin, Texas, and executive director of the Connecticut Association for Human Services. Mr. Gianfrido also served in the Connecticut State Legislature and as mayor of Middletown, Connecticut. He's written extensively on behavioral health issues, including his critically acclaimed book, Losing Tim, How Our Health and Education Systems Failed My Son with Schizophrenia. He's a graduate of Wesleyan University and a good friend of ours. Paul, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you for inviting me to be on.
Oh, that's great. You know, we're in the middle of National Mental Health Awareness Month, and seems that recently there's actually some momentum around the efforts to address the epidemic of unmet behavioral health needs in this country. And when you look at the stats, you realize no one is immune. It's estimated that 1 in 5 Americans will have some diagnosable mental health issue in any given year, and yet many simply don't get help they need. I wonder if you could tell our listeners about the impact of unmet behavioral health needs in this country and why diagnosis and treatment pose such a challenge.
Well, for the longest time, we've treated mental health concerns and conditions as public safety problems and not as public health problems. As a result, when we deinstitutionalized our population in the 1980s, we reinstitutionalized that population. And when we closed our state mental health beds and facilities, we reopened them as county jails and state prisons. That puts a real damper on people's willingness to seek help and to take out into the open the kinds of symptoms they've got, the kinds of feelings they've got, the kind of concerns they've got. What Mental Health Month since 1949, when we began to sponsor it, has been about is taking a month where people can talk about mental health openly. People can talk about what it feels like to have a mental illness openly. And we can begin to move from this public safety model to a public health model and get services better integrated into the regular healthcare delivery system.
Well, Paul, you've had a lengthy career in public service, and you have focused so much effort on improving mental health. And now you're at the helm of the nation's oldest organization dedicated to promoting earlier diagnoses and improving access to mental health services. So talk with us about the key goals of Mental Health America and how your local partnerships and efforts like your B4 Stage 4 program are really positioned to help achieve these goals.
Yeah, what Mental Health America stands for is 4 things. Prevention for all, early identification and intervention for those at risk, integrated health, behavioral health, and other services such as education services, housing supports, employment supports for those who need them, with recovery as the goal. While that's a great elevator speech, and what we found in recent years is you have to be able to put this into 140 characters or less. So we've made mental health concerns and conditions the only chronic diseases we wait until stage four to treat. So a year and a half ago, we launched our Before Stage Four initiative, which is designed to move people's attention upstream in the process, to have people think about intervening at stage one or stage two, not waiting till a crisis has occurred. And we've put a lot of our resources by launching an online screening program to make ubiquitous screening the goal of everyone in America, because we believe that kids should be screened for mental health concerns as frequently as they're screened for vision or hearing. We think adults should be screened as frequently as they're screened for blood pressure, and the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force agrees with us. They think everybody over the age of 11 ought to be screened annually for mental health.
Well, Paul, you just announced this ambitious initiative with the Walgreens change, and the goal is to provide behavioral health screening for at least 3 million people through Walgreens' national network of stores in the coming years. Tell our listeners a little more about the program, how it's going to be administrated, and how will folks who receive diagnosis will get interventions they need in a timely fashion.
Millions of people come to us via our website and through social media, and millions of people every day visit Walgreens' website. So initially, we've put this together to operate in this virtual environment where if people go to mhascreening.org, they're able to screen anonymously using the very same clinical tools that their doctor might use for depression, for anxiety, for psychosis, and for other conditions. Walgreens has now put a link from their website onto our screening page so that we can get more people to screen. What we're providing for Walgreens is a set of online tools and resources that people will be able to use post-screening to learn more about the conditions they've got. And what Walgreens is going to be able to provide are some more linkages to their Chat with a Pharmacist program, for example. Our local affiliates, we have 100 of them around the country, will be in a position to take referrals as well and get people connected to local providers and other support services in their communities so that we will have a fully fleshed out screening to supports program.
Many in the healthcare profession find themselves when trying to manage behavioral health issues. Often patients don't follow through with recommended treatment, but we know that that's often a consequence of there being nothing to follow through with, right?
So, that's right.
But I'm interested in this breakthrough system that Walgreens is using, and that may be part of what you were referring to, that facilitates interaction with clinicians online and includes a medication adherence tool. Talk about how emerging technologies like this are making a large-scale program possible in a way that would have been very difficult to achieve in the past, and what's unique about this one?
Yeah, in the past, we were pretty much tied to physical locations. If they wanted to get adherence tools, for example, or adherence supports, they'd pretty much have to go to someone or someplace. You know, in recent years, the online environments have changed this dramatically, and there are a lot of services that are moving into digital space. The best ones are Fitbits, which give you instantaneous feedback about certain things that are going on in your body, like your heart rate and the number of steps you're taking and things like that. We're trying to take advantage of the fact that young people especially are interested in using these kinds of tools. Three-quarters of the people who use our screening tools are under the age of 25. Two-thirds of those people tell us they've never been diagnosed with anything. Pretty hard to get somebody to adhere to treatment when they've never received a diagnosis and they aren't really in treatment. So what we're trying to get them to do is take a next step with some of these tools and actually be willing to talk further about it, be willing to take their results to a clinician at stage one in the process where recovery comes a lot easier.
We're speaking today with Paul Gianfrido, President and CEO of Mental Health America, the nation's oldest community-based not-for-profit organization committed to improving mental health in this country. Mr. Gianfrido also served on the National Advisory Council at the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Service Administration at HHS. Paul, you've written about your own personal experience navigating the mental health system in your book, Losing Tim, How Our Health and Education Systems Failed My Son with Schizophrenia. And you even noted as a young lawmaker, you inadvertently supported laws that made screening treatment options more difficult for families to access. I wonder if you could pull those together and share with us the story about Tim and the navigation that you had to go through with the Connecticut system, and also give us an update on how Tim's doing.
Yeah, Tim right now is 31 years old, and for the last 10 years, he's been mostly homeless on the streets of San Francisco. Recently, he's come back into services a little bit, has had some housing. We actually got a chance to visit him about 6 weeks ago, and he was doing very well and hoping at this point to stay in services. But all too frequently, when he's come back into housing first, He's tended to be evicted from that housing, and then we lose track of him for weeks or months at a time again. Part of the reason he's evicted is because he just doesn't follow the rules because he's got schizophrenia and can't. What I think we made as our biggest mistake in the 1980s was not understanding that while the people who are coming out of our state hospitals were adults, the people who were going into them were kids. Half of all mental illnesses emerge by the age of 14. And these are childhood diseases, childhood problems, and we never built a system of supports around our children. What happened to Tim is what happens to a lot of kids like that. They get into the school system, and the schools have no idea what to do with them. Even though they're legally required to provide individualized services and programs for those kids, it's a lot easier for them when a child has a physical disability or a chronic disease that's more easily recognized than a serious mental illness. And so I think that that's the mistake we made as a matter of public policy. It's a mistake policymakers have doubled down on in the course of the last 30 years. So it's not just that Tim ends up where he is with a pretty tragic outcome, but not as tragic as the worst outcomes that many, many parents and families have had to deal with. We're continuing to see policies in America that are going to continue to put more people like Tim out on the streets. And we at Mental Health America are really trying to put in place policies that will recognize early, that will get services to kids in the schools, in their communities early on, and that will change the trajectories of these kids' lives.
Well, Paul, families often encounter the toughest challenges once kids age out of the system and aren't eligible for some of those supportive programs they may have had. And certainly as the state budgets are floundering, we see families finding it tougher and tougher to find safe homes and dependable programs for their adult children who grapple with complex mental health issues. And in fact, The Atlantic just had a very powerful article describing the nation's jails and prisons as the largest mental health hospitals in the country. I wonder if we could talk a little more about solutions. Where are the solutions for these young adults and older adults now? You know, Tim is an example, and Tim's got the most supportive family in the world trying to help him, but lots of folks don't. So what are the solutions to really help these people?
Well, I think the simplest solution is, in a way, the most obvious one. We've asked the members of Congress to include a provision in federal reform legislation, which remains in the House bill at this point, that would end the incarceration of nonviolent offenders with serious mental illness within 10 years. States could do that as well, because there's plenty of money and plenty of resources out there. But we've got to stop putting people in jail, and we've got to stop using the jails as treatment programs for adults. If we did that, we would free up literally millions and millions of dollars that we would be able to put into the building of the community-based mental health systems that we promised to people back in the 1980s. And it's as simple as that, I think. Let's get them out of the jails, and let's move the money from the jails to follow the people back out in the communities, put clinical support folks, peers, clinicians into the mix, as opposed to just judges and lawyers and police officers.
You know, Paul, you've talked about getting behavioral health services to children early on. We've also been very committed to sort of redefining the primary care space and have made available to schools throughout our state the opportunity to have a behavioralist full-time in their school. And so many schools are responding to that to offer. We're in a couple hundred right now. But also in the primary care space, you know, the embedded behavioralist in primary care. We really need to take advantage of the care delivery system and try to have people reimagine the way delivery might happen. And, you know, we're very committed to making sure there are warm handoffs between the behavioralist and medical and back. And we note that the Affordable Care Act is out there trying to promote models aimed at better outcomes. What do you see as interesting initiatives in the primary care space that people in the country should be keeping an eye on?
Well, you're way more forward-thinking and forward-acting than a lot of folks in the rest of the country are, and that's just a fact. What I think that people need to be doing, even in areas where people haven't been as progressive in their thinking, is first and foremost making certain that primary care clinicians are educated to and informed about the need for integration of health and behavioral health services. A lot of these responsibilities fall on them anyway, whether they're pediatricians or adult service providers. I think similarly, the behavioral health providers need to understand better about how to integrate their work into primary care and into educational settings and others. I really do think we have to break down a lot of the barriers between the schools and the educators who understand that their primary purpose is to educate kids, but don't always understand that some kids aren't available to learn unless you deal with their health issues as well. And particularly that's the case when you're dealing with mental health issues. And I think that involves providing supports into the educational system. But if we then turn around and have a special ed system that says, if you're going to provide those supports, you've got to pay for them, most schools are going to continue to be reluctant to do that. So I think we also need to reform some of our special education laws and maybe take a look at allowing mandatory parts of kids' individualized education programs be covered not by the education department, but by their kids' private health insurance if it's otherwise available, to provide some of those services and supports. Mm-hmm. I think we just have to reimagine this system. We have to, again, take a step back and say, this is about health. It's about health for kids. It's about health for adults. It's not about safety. And we have to throw out what we've done, which is in school suspension, expulsion. With adults, it's putting them into jails and prisons. And we have to say, okay, how do we do the kinds of things you guys are doing? How do we start with kids and say, purpose is to keep kids in their families, to keep kids in their schools. The purpose is to keep adults with their families, to keep them in their jobs, and then figure out what it is we need to do to keep them there. And whether that's a service that's provided on site, and maybe it's provided by a clinician, maybe it's just provided by a peer, or if in the case of kids, maybe it's provided by a mentor. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of tools we have in the tool chest. And as I say in the book, it's a chain of neglect when we don't do anything. And there are a lot of ways to break a chain. You only have to do it in one place, though. Mm-hmm. And that's what will change things. So I think all of these are potential strategies. And we just have to get everybody in the country who haven't even envisioned the idea of integrating services yet mm-hmm. in any meaningful way to just start thinking about it.
Well, we're working hard at trying to get that message and the tools to do that across the country. But, Paul, you serve on the advisory council at the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, along with so many other things that you're doing. We had the administrator, Kana Enomoto, on the show recently talking about efforts to provide more budgetary support for critical behavioral health issues. And certainly we were talking about the just enormous problem of addiction right now, and particularly opioid addiction. I wonder how your organization is grappling with this mix of both the mental illness issues and also the addiction issues that have just so powerfully swept across the country again with the opioid crisis. How are you reaching out to help families who are dealing with addiction as well as mental illness?
Yeah, and just sidebar, I think that Kana and Sams are doing a great job with the resources that they've got and trying to make people aware of these mm-hmm. Crises and to try to deal with them. I think we have something of a different take on it as well, and that is that we have seen, certain drugs become gateways, and I think people think of them as sort of gateways to these worse drugs, the opioids, and thinking particularly of drugs like marijuana, which for a lot of our population have been, for lack of a better way to describe it, effective self-management of symptoms that have landed people as a gateway to jail. What I think we need to do is to, and I think we generally think, we need to rethink a lot of the way we fought our war on drugs here and figure out a way to make available to people the kinds of pharmaceuticals that they need that will actually mitigate symptoms and not really force them into employing strategies to get pharmaceuticals that may not be quite the ones they need and may be even more highly addictive mm-hmm. and that are creating a lot of the crisis that, frankly, has been around in our country, for generations now, but has been confined largely to low-income communities and mm-hmm. minority communities. And it's only in recent years that people have begun to notice that actually this is everywhere. I remember, one high school principal telling me, and I tell this story a little bit about when Tim was growing up, that he was saying, okay, for the first time this year, we're talking 1990s, marijuana was in our high school, it was a suburban high school. And I wanted to tell him, when I was in high school, marijuana was in your high school. But, we ignored some of this for an awful long time, and I think we're paying the price ignoring this.
We've been speaking with Paul Gianfrido, president and CEO of Mental Health America, the nation's oldest organization dedicated to improving behavioral health services for all people in this country. You can learn more about their work by going to mentalhealthamerica.net or following them on Twitter at mentalhealtham. Paul, thank you so much for joining us today. Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Donald Trump said hairspray's not like it used to be because chemicals in it that affect the ozone layer have been banned. Many countries began phasing out the ozone-depleting substances in hairspray in the late 1980s, but these regulations wouldn't affect the quality of hairspray. Trump also said using hairspray in his apartment, which he said was all sealed, would prevent any ozone-depleting substances from escaping into the environment. But these chemicals would still make their way out, experts told us. Trump has been making false claims about hairspray in the ozone layer for at least 5 years and most recently made these statements at a rally in West Virginia. Hairspray is made up of chemicals that make hair stiff and a propellant. Before the signing of the Montreal Protocol in 1987, hairspray and other aerosols used chlorofluorocarbons as propellants. CFCs are potent ozone-depleting substances. A weakened ozone layer leads to an increase in ultraviolet radiation, which then brings about higher rates of skin cancer, cataracts, and immune system problems in human populations. The gravity of the issue prompted countries to phase out CFCs. Hairspray now uses HFCs, or hydrofluorocarbons, and the ozone layer is recovering. But these regulations have nothing to do with the stiffening agent in the spray, only the propellant that propels the stiffening agent out of the can. As for Trump's sealed apartment, we interviewed both a chemist and a physicist with the National Oceanic Atmospheric Administration. They told us it makes no difference if you spray chemicals inside or outside. They will eventually make it outside, moving through the lower atmosphere over months before being transported up to the stratosphere. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. For all the people in the world without limbs, acquiring prosthetics can be costly and out of reach. It's especially challenging to make prosthetics for children since they are in constant state of growth. Rochester Institute of Technology scientist Dr. John Shule stumbled upon a clever and affordable solution, provided online open source templates to anyone anywhere in the world who has access to a 3D printer, and provide prosthetic hands for next to nothing.
I've made this Google Maps mashup. If you have a 3D printer and you'd like to help, put yourself on this map. And if you know someone who needs a hand, put yourself on this map.
So he founded the Enable Network, which has massed thousands of volunteer makers in upwards of 40 countries around the world, providing cheap but functional prosthetics for children in need.
I think we're currently pushing 5,800 identified members in our Google Plus community, and we have followings in the thousands more. We know that we've delivered about 800 hands, and we suspect that this comparable number have been downloaded by people we can't track because we put all of our design on the internet.
The simple limb designs have become more sophisticated as recipients of the prosthetic devices provide feedback for designers to make more efficient devices.
We're still working on opposable thumbs. We're still working on individual finger movements. These things grip or ungrip. That's all they do. So they're much less functional than a biological hand, and they're also less functional than a fancy myoelectric hand. But for kids, it's huge because those expensive devices are typically out of reach for children who would outgrow them. So it doesn't make sense for them to get a $5,000 or $10,000 hand. And, you know, our hands don't even pretend to look like regular hands. They look like superhero Iron Man hands. And for that very reason, they're very popular with kids.
Enable, a global collaborative network of open source designs, linking to makers with 3D printers to provide low-cost prosthetic limbs to children and adults around the world who might otherwise not be able to afford them. Now that's a bright idea.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at wesufm.org and brought to you by the Community Health Center.